number 18771, Reel 2.
Mrs. Watts, Reel 2. You were just about to tell me something.
My father worked in industry. It was a factory that made raw materials to treat raw wool. I mean, nothing very much. But he knew a thing or two. And basically he said from the beginning, we can never win this war. It's just not possible. Economically, supply-wise, oil, raw materials. Germany will be a little island. Where is it going to come from? So from that point of view, you see, and obviously in a situation like that, I dare say you hope against hope that everything will be all right. Because that's your sense of self-preservation, isn't it? And as time went by, it became more and more apparent that, well, it would be, as people feared, the worst. You know, it had to.
So your father didn't trust what the media was saying?
Oh, no. No.
Do you actually remember? Do you remember Kristallnacht?
No, not as such. I only remember my father coming home from the office saying there's been an awful lot of trouble in town because we lived on the outskirts of Berlin. There's been an awful lot of trouble in town. They have smashed up the shops and some of the synagogues. Now, at that time, I didn't even know what a synagogue was, because I must have been, what, 9? Was it?
Possibly 13.
Was it in...
38, was it?
Was it that late? Kristallnacht.
Anyway, you were young.
Yeah. No, I don't remember that much about it. I think when what I've just said happened just after 33, when they were starting to smash up the shops, and then later on when you said Kristallnacht, that was later. But to be honest, I don't remember much about that.
Do you remember Chamberlain's declaration of war on Germany?
Oh yes. Well, when he came to Germany, and when it looked as if war had been averted, I remember the people of my parents' generation were very, very relieved. And when it came to pass that it all went the other way, I remember people of my teachers at school who were quite advanced in years and what have you, a lot of people actually cried. Older people, not the young ones, of course. Older people that remembered the First World War actually cried when war was declared. War was declared, as far as I know, on a Sunday. And concurrently, on a Sunday, food rationing was brought in, and we hadn't known anything about it before. It was kept so quiet, it was absolutely Teutonic thoroughness. We were told over the radio that on the Monday people would go to wherever places they had to go, stations, they'd get their ration cards, and that would be it. And that was it.
What were your own feelings about the war declaration?
have to think about that. I don't think at that age, okay, I was 14, but I had led a very sheltered life and a very good life and a very happy life, and I do not think that I realized what it meant. I realized it must be, my parents were very, very subdued and very, very depressed. And from that, of course, I deduced, oh my goodness, what's coming to meet us? But when you're young, I think, you don't realize.
Before we go on to the war, can I ask you about the period from 33 to 39 when Hitler was in power during peacetime? You said about his social program. Did everyday life change for Berliners?
Very much indeed. We, as I said before, we had the unemployment, and it was quite miraculous how the unemployed started to disappear from the street, because for one thing, he created the Reichsarbeitsdienst, how do we call it?
Work service?
Something like that, yes. They were given uniforms. Obviously, in those days, they weren't given a rifle. They marched along with spades, and they started building the Autobahn, building up all sorts of things. Somehow or other, people got work. I cannot remember whether with the advent of his taking power, the Wehrmacht was reintroduced, was it?
Instead of the Reichswehr?
Instead of the Reichswehr? It must have been. So a lot of people were absorbed into that. What else? By and large, life began to be completely different, and especially the blue collar workers, the working class in the factories, farms, and so on and so on, were given a real status. I don't know if Kraft durch Freude is known here. It was a sort of association, workers' association, whereby, through which they went on outings. It was purely for your working class people. And I don't mean that in any working class in any derogatory way. It's just to give them a name, you know, to give the class a name. People from the factories and such like, they had their outings. They even had a small flotilla of ships where they cruised the Baltic. They were sent on holiday to holiday camps, I think. And of course, for people who had been very poor and who had not been able to afford anything, it was a marvelous thing. I can't really, from the economical point of view, I cannot remember any details other than, I think, because the Wehrmacht was built up and because this other faction, the Arbeitsdienst, people had a good life.
As far as you were concerned at school, did you have any political influence through your schooling?
No. School, basically from 33 to 39, school was school. All you had to do in the morning was, you didn't pray anymore, because the National Socialists were against religion, the teachers came in and said, Heil Hitler. And we said, Heil Hitler.
With the salute.
With the salute. And later on, grammar school, it was very funny. A couple of our older teachers just went.
We went. A perfunctory
wave. A wave of the hand, you know, and that was it. But basically, no, school wasn't affected. Not mine, anyway. That's all I can say, you know. I don't know whether other schools in other towns or had a different attitude. I don't know. We didn't have any political indoctrination or anything at school.
This perfunctory wave was really because they didn't approve.
Derogatory. You know.
They had to do something.
They had to do something, yes. Yes.
Now, coming on to the war, did the war affect you at first?
It affected me immediately because, A, there was rationing, B, you were issued with a gas mask, which I believe people in Britain carried on their person all the time, which we at first did and then stopped. You were told about what to do when the siren went, as it would do. I have told you before, we lived in flats, and there were more or less very often blocks of flats, and every so many blocks of flats had a person responsible to see that they went into the cellar, and which we did. We didn't stay upstairs. We didn't stay under table shelters. I don't think we would be here talking if I had been in a table shelter. We went right down to the cellars, which very hastily had been reinforced, and there we stayed. Every time the siren went, and then when the all clear sounded, we went upstairs again. The rationing affected us, of course, straight away. It was quite severe-ish, and we certainly couldn't go into a restaurant and eat without coupons, without ration coupons. That didn't exist. On your menu, you had all the foods listed, not as elaborate as before, but you had the foods. But beside it was, you have to give up 5 grams of flour, 10 grams of potatoes, 6 grams of sugar. Every dish was broken down into the components of whatever it contained, and you had to give up your coupons for it. There was usually one dish which was coupon free, as we called it, which was usually a very watery soup, which you might as well not eat. But you did eat it because you were hungry. Later on, when I went out a bit at night, when I had a boyfriend at about age 16, you couldn't get alcohol much anymore. You were given something like pink, whatever. It was an artificial taste. Very, very little alcohol. They stopped public dancing. In Berlin, we had nightclubs. We had what we called dance cafes, where there was public dancing, and it was stopped because it was said that the German population should not dance frivolously while the soldiers at the front were dying. At the time, I thought, well, the poor soldiers, when they come home on leave, why shouldn't they enjoy a little dance? I mean, there were two sides to it, weren't there? But there we are, it wasn't allowed. So people just sat at the table and had an ersatz coffee or whatever and listened to the music. The music was allowed.
Did people obey the regulations on everyday life?
Oh yes, I should. As far as I'm aware, yes. Oh yes. You couldn't do anything else. Definitely not. I remember one incident. There was a nightclub on two levels. And my friends and I were sitting upstairs. We were the only ones with our boyfriends. I was 16 then. Downstairs, everybody was sitting at the tables and the dance band was playing. Nobody moved. And we started dancing in the back of this second, of the balcony thing. And in no time at all, the manager came up and said, "You stop that, or you're out." Yeah?
Which places would you go to at this age for entertainment?
You could call them bars. It was a little bit like London in Berlin. You had big nightclubs where you had floor shows and dancing in between. You had small cafes, dance cafes, which they were quite small places, and very, very small dance floors, and just a few tables. And you would go there. You'd go to the cinema. You would go to restaurants if you sometimes found you had a few coupons to spare. Or, as I said before, you had the coupon free, whatever it was. Yeah, this is what I did. Don't know what other people. I do believe some people managed to get quite a bit on the black market wherever it was. I don't know. Unfortunately, we didn't until very much later on.
But when you were 18, you went to university.
Sorry?
When you were 18 years old, you went to the university.
When I was 18 years old, after my school leaving exam, I had to go 6 months to the Land Army in order to be allowed to go to university. And I'll tell you why that was. That was because Hitler basically was against the intellectuals. Intellectuals were dangerous and thought, and he couldn't afford that. And therefore, we were all supposed to mix and mingle with the farmers, with the land workers, with the people who worked with the hand, to get all sorts of silliness knocked out of us and see how the other half lived, and also not to get the stuffing knocked out of us, but I can't quite explain what I mean, but to knuckle under, let's say, physically. The Land Army was totally different from the British Land Army. We were given dresses. We didn't have trousers. We were given dresses. We were given army boots, to here.
Up to the ankle.
Up to the ankle. We wore thick grey ankle socks and a red kerchief on the hair. And then we were just farmed out. First of all, we were all gathered in a camp. They were all over Germany, of course. We gathered in the camp. In my camp, there were about 100. We lived in barracks, in rooms 14 to a room, a big camp, with two-tiered steel bunks with palliasses, which were damp. Wooden floors, wooden table, and a stove thing, an iron stove thing with a pipe going out, right? We had a week's introduction and what have you, and then we were farmed out to the farmers on bikes. we had to all go get on a bike and go out to the farmers. And here's something very interesting. In those days, when I was in the Land Army, the war with France had finished, and there were a lot of prisoner of wars working for the farmers, because obviously the farmers were short of labour because they were all at the front. And before we were allowed out of the camp, by the way, was party run. Our leaders, three girls, very young girls, because Hitler was always of the opinion that youth should be led by youth, right? They said, we were told that under no circumstances must we talk to the French prisoners of war. I remember the words clearly. Those people do not exist for us. You do not talk to them, and if you find that your farmer lets them eat at the table, you will take your plate and sit down somewhere else. Right, so then we did our bit. We did old-fashioned farming, hay, mowing the hay. There were no combine harvesters. I don't know, but what do you call it when you, the old-fashioned way when you...
Stuken.
That's right. Stuken we called it. Good. Stuka, yeah. And loading the wagons as well. And also throwing it into the threshing machine. Old-fashioned farming. And, of course, I might as well finish that off now. There was a French POW at my farmers, and at first I just observed, and then of course very, very soon I started talking to him, because we'd had 8 years of French at grammar school and had never spoken to a French person. And it was quite interesting. I mean, we didn't have a great deep conversation, or just, you know, just a few words, and that was it. And of course he sat at the table, and of course we all act together. And I got into deep trouble, because when I came home that night, and we were sitting after supper, we were sitting in our room, 14 of us, we were talking about our experiences, and I said, yes, well, there is Edmond, and I talked to him. He's a very nice fellow. He's a bus driver. And I then said, I, for one, do not agree with the attitude of these people don't exist for us, because the war hasn't finished yet. And we might one day be counting on the mercy of these people, right? Which is what I felt. And that was immediately the next day reported to the leadership, and there was quite a bit of trouble, because that was a defeatist remark, that was an anti-Hitler remark. I was immediately confined to barracks. And I thought, oh dear me, this is going to be bad. So I asked one of my friends to immediately contact my father, which she did. She phoned him. And this was in the morning. They went out. I wasn't allowed to leave camp. And they started interrogating me. Such and such a thing had been reported. And what did I mean by a remark like that? And I must be honest, I was so scared, I couldn't think. I didn't know what to say. I said, what did I answer? I don't think I answered at all. I just sort of stuttered and stumbled and said, well, you know, I thought it was so nice to talk to him because we've had 8 years of French and that sort of thing. And luckily enough, at that moment, this was later on in the afternoon, at that moment, my father came through the gates of the camp and was immediately shown into the room. And it threw the management, the leadership. Because let's not forget, these girls were not very bright. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been where they were. They were dedicated Nazis. They were very young. They were 21, 22. And my father at that time was 56, 55-year-old man who knew a lot about life. I was sent out of the room, and I believe he started talking to them. He told me later on. And apparently, he wiped the floor with them and said, they were going to hand me over to the Gestapo. And he wiped the floor with them. We just had a very, very heavy air raid at that time. I think it was the Romanian oil fields that had been bombed. And he told me later, he said, my dear ladies, what do you think you're on about, making so much to do about a silly schoolgirl's remarks, when the very existence, when our very lives are at stake? Yeah? I don't know what, I have forgotten what else. Anyway, I wasn't handed over. I got 6 weeks arrest, had to stay in camp for 6 weeks, wasn't allowed out. And when they went to the cinema, I had to stay in. I had to clean the latrines and that sort of, you know. So that was my little experience of having a brush with the system. Luckily enough, it went all right, but, you know.
Where did you do your period of land army service?
It was very near Berlin. It was called, in a region called Niederlausitz. But I've forgotten the actual name of the little village that we were attached to. After the war, I happened to run into one of the girls that had been our leaders. Of course, after the war, when the Russians were in Berlin, things were totally different. We walked past a nursery, my mother and I. My father had died. My mother and I walked past a nursery